you for having us here today. We have one additional case to argue this morning. I'm Chief Justice Terry Livingston. To my right is Justice Bill Meyer, and to my left is Justice Lee Gabriel. We've already met and some of our folks and attorneys here who are helping us today. We will call this one case EOG Resources Inc. versus James R. Kirk. We have Mr. James P. arguing for appellant, and Mr. Clinton Phillips arguing for appellee. Mr. Key.
May it please the court, counsel. This case is about a non-party to an 11,000-acre oil and gas lease who filed suit seeking damages under the lease for lost or missing cattle and forfeiture of this lease. Now, there are essentially three legal issues in this appeal, all of which should be reviewed in NOVA. Number one, whether Mr. Hurt is a third-party credit beneficiary to the oil and gas lease. Number two, whether Mr. Hurt suffered a compensable legal injury. And last, whether Mr. Hurt has standing to sue EOG. A fourth issue in this appeal is whether the trial court erred in refusing to terminate the 11,000-acre oil and gas lease, and that issue should be reviewed under legal sufficiency review. Now, with respect to the third-party beneficiary issue, Mr. Hurt's entire case is premised on him being a lessor's tenant under the oil and gas lease. However, Mr. Hurt is not a lessor's tenant. Mr. Hurt admitted on cross-examination that in 2008, he had a cash release with Molly Houston, non-standard investment company. That can be found in the record in Volume 2, page 87, line 4, through page 88, line 12. Standard Investment Company is not named anywhere in the Molly Houston cash release. And there's no evidence that Molly Houston acted for on behalf of Standard Investment Company. Mr. Hurt is playing fast and loose with this record. And this court should not accept his premise that he is a lessor's tenant. However, even if Mr. Hurt was a lessor's tenant, it wouldn't matter under the facts of this case. Paragraph 13D of the oil and gas lease specifically states that damages for lost or missing cattle are to be paid to the lessor, not the lessor's tenant, which makes this case just like the Finder v. Stanford case. In the Finder case, we are dealt with a situation where a surface tenant sued an oil and gas company for damages to the land after the oil and gas company allowed some drilling mud to escape. In that case, the Houston Court of Appeals held that the surface tenant could not sue the oil and gas company for damages to the land under the oil and gas lease because that lease specifically provided that damages to the land, whether the damages belong to the lessor or the lessor's tenant, would be paid to the lessor. That is exactly what we have in this case. Paragraph 13D, damages paid to the lessor, not the lessor's tenant.
So at trial, were you all able to prove that there was no valid lease, verbal or written, between your client or Standard and the appellee?
No valid lease between them. The evidence was conclusive, Your Honor, and the testimony at trial, there's over 10 pages of testimony, Your Honor, between pages 74 and pages 84 in the second volume of the reporter's record. Mr. Hurt testified at length that in 2004, at the time this oil and gas lease was entered into, he had no contracts, no obligations, nothing to do with either EOG or Standard Investment Company. He wasn't an employee of them. In fact, he even admitted that no one at EOG even knew who he was. Your Honor, he admitted that this oil and gas lease was not entered into his benefit and that he didn't receive any benefits, or it wasn't for his benefit, Your Honor. That evidence, it's conclusive. There's absolutely no evidence in this record at all that back in 2004, either EOG or Standard Investment Company owed Mr. Hurt anything, which is fatal to his third-party creditor beneficiary claim. Mr. Hurt claims that he is a creditor beneficiary, and in order to be a creditor beneficiary as a matter of law, there has to be two things present. One, there has to be an existing obligation that's owed at the time that the agreement to And secondly, the performance under the contract of being enforced has to come in complete satisfaction or a discharge or to protect the existing obligation. No evidence in this case. And moreover, when you're looking at the evidence, you have to look at the four corners of the agreement to be enforced. And the Ortega case tells us that within the body of the agreement to be enforced, we need to have those two things. There must be evidence acknowledging the existing obligation and performance and satisfaction of that. And I'll submit to the court, there is nothing in this oil and gas lease that would evidence that intent. So therefore, his claim fails as a matter of law. Moreover, Mr. Hurd argues, even if he was a lessor's tenant, he claims that that would somehow give him the right to sue. But that argument ignores the Texas law that being part of a broad class or group of people is not sufficient. Again, in the Ortega case, the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals stated that the contract being enforced must clearly and fully express the party's intent to benefit the specific third party bringing the claim. The court said that it's not enough that the contract is designed to benefit a broad class of people. Well, that's exactly what Mr. Hurd is trying to do here. He is trying to jump into status, enforceable status, as some member of a broad class of someone who's a lessor's tenant. We don't know. The evidence is conclusive that he was not a lessor's tenant in 2004. And there's no evidence in the record of whether there were any other lessors or lessors tenants at that time. As the Supreme Court stated in Stewart versus Stein, the focus is whether the contracting parties intended to confer a benefit to the third party who's bringing the claim. And that point is further illustrated in the Dennis Jewelry case. In that case, we had a third party who claimed that it was a subscriber to security monitoring services. The San Antonio Court of Appeals said, you know what? You're right. You are a subscriber. There's absolutely no doubt that you're a subscriber of security monitoring services. But your claim still fails. And the reason that it does is because when you look at the contract to be enforced, it could be said unmistakably that the contracting parties intended to benefit that subscriber over any other person who could qualify as a subscriber. It's undisputed that Mr. Hurd had no rights to run cattle on the Houston Ranch in 2004, and there's nothing in this oil and gas lease to indicate that the parties intended to benefit him as opposed to anyone else. And faced with that realization and the fallacy of his argument, Mr. Hurd writes on page 16 of his appellee's brief, and I'll quote, "The Houston Ranch leased surface acreage during the years in question to one person, Jay Hurd." Page 16, Appley's brief. Your Honors, that statement, there is no evidence in this record at all to substantiate that statement. There's no evidence to back it up. The court should reject Mr. Hurd's broad class argument. And as for Mr. Hurd's claim that he's entitled to enforce the lease as a creditor beneficiary, again, it wouldn't matter because there's no evidence of this existing obligation and a discharge. That evidence was conclusive. Moreover, the oil and gas lease doesn't express the clear intent. Nowhere in there does it recognize an existing obligation that's owed by EOG or Standard Investment Company, nor does it contain any acknowledgement of a discharge of that. This is like an important satisfaction situation. You have an existing debt, and the parties are going to later do something to extinguish the earlier debt. So therefore, his claim fails as a creditor beneficiary because there's no clear intent. And moreover, the third reason why he can't prevail as a creditor beneficiary because he doesn't have the right to sue, which is critical. As previously noted, paragraph 13 says that, well, for lost or missing cattle, which is what we're talking about in this case, damages are paid to the lessor. It doesn't say anything about a lessor's tenant. So therefore, on its face, there's no right to sue. What Mr. Hurd is really asking this court to do is to rewrite this oil and gas lease and take paragraph 13D, which talks about lost or missing cattle, and then jump over to paragraph 13F, and I've set forth both of those provisions for the court's convenience. to look at. What he really wants this court to do is to redraft 13D and combine the language out of 13F that says, oh, for lost or missing cattle, well, I know it says we're going to pay damages to the lessor, but 13F says, damages to livestock, we can pay the lessor's tenant for that. But that is not correct, Your Honor. 13F deals with injury or damage to cattle that result from a failure to use reasonable care. That's not what this case is about. In fact, Mr. Hurd testified that he had no evidence of any injury to cattle, no evidence of damage to cattle, no evidence of any cattle being crippled. And you know why? Because this is a case about lost or missing cattle, and no one had ever seen these cattle since June 21st of 2008. It's legally impossible for him to testify as to an injury because he doesn't know what happened to these cattle. And that's why paragraph 13F doesn't apply. And this court isn't allowed to rewrite the party's agreement. Moreover, no right to enforce under paragraph 26. Under paragraph 26, that provision of the oil and gas lease specifically states that the terms and the provisions of the lease inure to the benefit of the following people: the lessor, owners, and then their heirs, successors, and assigns. And it further states that those people are the only ones that are entitled to enforce the oil and gas lease. It says nothing about a lessor's tenant, and that is critical. The cases, the right to sue is a critical function of third-party beneficiary cases. Your Honor, subjective intent doesn't matter. This is an objective intent standard. It's what the parties said, and that intent has to be clearly and fully expressed. There's a strong presumption against third-party beneficiaries, and even if Jaker would have received an incidental benefit under the contract, or even if he would have had a substantial interest in his performance, that doesn't matter under our law. Mr. Hertz simply cannot recover as a third-party creditor beneficiary. Now, let's talk about principal legal injury. It's undisputed that the cattle in this case belong to John Bill Homan, not Jay Hurt. And recognizing that the cattle belong to someone else, Mr. Hurt has tried to manufacture an injury by saying he has liability to John Bill Homan under a grazing agreement. However, Mr. Hurt doesn't have any liability to John Bill Homan because, you know why? There was a Chapter 13 bankruptcy that was filed after this lawsuit was filed. And therefore, Mr. Homan's claim is barred by res judicata. Under the law, in order to enforce a claim that's otherwise subject to the bankruptcy automatic stay and discharge, a creditor like John Bill Homan is required to file a proof of claim in the bankruptcy court. In this case, it's undisputed that John Bill Homan had notice of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy. That can be found in the second reporter's record, page 252, lines 1 through 7. That was page 252, line through 7, 1 through 7. It's undisputed that he did not file a proof of claim. That can be found in the second reporter's record, page 234, lines 16 through 18. And he's not been paid out of the assets or paid from the Chapter 13 bankruptcy plan.
Is there any evidence that Dr. Arnold was listed as one of Mr. Hurd's
creditors? Yes, it is. It's Exhibit 9, Plaintiff's Exhibit 9. And that was, Schedule F was amended in May 2010. Yes, Your Honor. We have 2 minutes left. Mr. Hurd even admitted that John Bill Homan had notice of the October 10 confirmation order confirming the bankruptcy. That's at page 228, lines 11 through 19. John Bill Homan's claim is barred as a matter of law, and therefore there's no legal injury. And as far as this reaffirmation of the debt argument that Mr. Hurd would like to convince this court that he has somehow resurrected a legal injury, that claim fails because under section 524C of the bankruptcy code, in order to reaffirm the debt that's subject to discharge, the debtor must file a written agreement with the bankruptcy court acknowledging the debt. There's no evidence that that ever happened in this case. To allow Mr. Hurd to recover damages will result in a windfall. And moreover, as a result of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy filing, Mr. Hurd doesn't have standing to sue. This court has held in Kilpatrick versus Kilpatrick that The bankruptcy trustee, being the representative of the bankruptcy estate, has exclusive standing to assert all claims on behalf of the bankruptcy court. That was a Chapter 13 bankruptcy case. It's consistent with the Texas Supreme Court's holding in Douglas versus Dell, which held that in Chapter 11, the bankruptcy trustee has exclusive standing. In all fairness, this court's opinion in Kilpatrick was criticized by the Martin case by the Dallas Court of Appeals. We believe Martin is wrongly decided for a number of reasons. Number one, being nowhere in the bankruptcy code is a Chapter 13 debtor given the express right to sue. And more importantly, it draws reasoning from the other circuit opinions around the country, being the 10th, 11th, 3rd, and 7th, which analogize this Chapter 13 to a Chapter 11 debtor in possession. But Douglas V. Dell tells us that Chapter 11 knows it's a bankruptcy trustee. Thank you, Norm.
Could I have a question for the lady?
Yes, sir.
I didn't hear you address all the argument that's, I know it's in the briefs, but I didn't hear you address the question of the stipulation and confirmation argument.
Yes, Your Honor. The stipulation is no evidence of anything. It was not admitted at the trial court. There's no evidence that it was ever presented to the bankruptcy court. There's no evidence that it was ever approved by the bankruptcy court. It's not dated. It's not signed by the debtor. It doesn't reference this lawsuit. It contains self-serving hearsay. Your Honor, it's simply evidence of nothing.
Was it included in evidence or offered in evidence?
It was not.
It was
submitted to the court coordinator by Mr. Hurt's counsel, but it was never admitted.
I thought it was part of the supplemental record. And I looked at it, but I didn't see it. It was marked as an exhibit, not admitted. I mean, you admitted most all of your exhibits at the start of the trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
This was one of them.
It was not admitted, and to my recollection, it was never offered.
I'm sorry.
At the time that the trial took place, was the bankruptcy still in? Had it been discharged, or what was the status of the bankruptcy at the time of the trial?
There's no evidence in the record as to what the status. The last piece of evidence in the record was that the bankruptcy was modified and confirmed by a confirmed order in October 2010. But there's no evidence of a discharge, and Your Honor, I'm not aware, and I won't represent the court one way or another because I don't know.
Thank you. Mr. Phillips. Members of this honorable court, my name is Quentin Eugene Phillips. And if it pleases the court, today I'll be representing Jay Hurt, the appellee cross-appellant in this matter. We're brought here today by the appeal of an oil and gas company from a judgment at trial court for $7,250 for lost cattle, and $25,000 for attorney's fees and cost of court. This award was made after a week of trial for the district court in Hood County and over a year of litigation. You've heard counsel or the appellant describe the appellant's version of the facts in this case, and the appellee's version is not dramatically different from the appellant's. The difference seems to lie in perspective. In 2005, the appellant in this case entered into a paid-up oil and gas lease with Standard Oil Investment Company, the owner of an 11,000-acre ranch known as the IT Houston Ranch. From Mr. Hurt's perspective, though he leased a portion of the Houston Ranch for purposes of running some cattle during the summer of 2008. Mr. Hurt was responsible for a group of cattle that were owned by Dr. John Bill Owen, a longtime friend and a person for whom he had previously run cattle. As often happens in cattle operations, it was necessary to move the cattle from one pasture to another pasture at a point in time very close to the point when they were about to be turned out for safety. Mr. Hurt examined the pasture, determined it looked pretty much the same as it had looked for the past 2 years he'd been running cattle on the property, and a couple weeks later, he moved the cattle into that pasture. What he found out later was that in the interim between the time he checked the pasture and the time he moved the cattle into the pasture, the appellant had caused work to be done on an oil and gas pad located in the pasture, and that the workers in doing that work had destroyed the fence and left it destroyed upon their exit. As a result, a number of cattle escaped, and this perimeter fence did not keep them in. Mr. Hurt crossed the perimeter fence, rounded up the amount of cattle that he could round up, and then thereafter, pursuant to the language contained in the paid-up oil and gas lease, he approached the appellant and said, "I'd like to be reimbursed for the 10 head of cattle that are now missing." In his communications with the appellant, he made some errors, but at trial, the jury believed his story. From Mr. Hurt's perspective, the appellant's failure to work with him to resolve this matter is the reason he didn't file a lawsuit. He had no options save the filing of a lawsuit or assuming the loss of the cattle to himself. And at trial, the jury believed his perspective. Today, we've heard counsel identify three basic issues that he wants to talk about here today. Those issues are that Mr. Hurt did not actually own the cattle. Number two, that the bankruptcy trustee was the proper person to bring the claim. And number three, that Mr. Hurt was not in fact a third-party beneficiary to the lease between Standard Oil, Standard Investments, and EOG. First, I would like to deal briefly with the Dr. Owen. He didn't really, Dr. Owen owned the cattle, not Mr. Hurt, so Dr. Owen should have been the one to bring the lawsuit on. This argument and the bankruptcy trustee argument that was urged later in Mr. Key's discussion were both waived at the trial court level. And I'd like to explain why. Essentially, these two arguments put forth the idea that Mr. Hurt did not have the standing to bring these types of claims. However, this court has previously ruled these identical type of arguments are not really standing arguments, but in fact, are capacity arguments. And as this court is aware, standing is an issue that cannot be waived, and capacity is an issue that can be waived. In Coastal Liquids Transport LP versus Harris County Appraisal District, 46 Southwest 3rd, 880, the Supreme Court wrote exactly this in 2001. As we have previously explained, a claimant has standing when it is personally aggrieved, regardless of whether it is acting with legal authority. A party has capacity when it has the legal authority to act, regardless of whether it has a judicial interest in the controversy. A party must have both standing and capacity to bring a lawsuit, and while standing as an issue cannot be waived, capacity can. As indicated earlier, we believe the appellant waived the Owen and bankruptcy trustee arguments at the trial court level, and the substance of the belief is this: in order to preserve capacity, one must file a Rule 93.2 verified petition, verified pleading at the trial court level, something the defendant appellant did not do at the trial court level. In support of this proposition, we offer the case of Jenkins versus Jenkins, 91 Southwest 2nd 440, where in 1999, this court held, when standing is offered to suggest the bankruptcy trustee's power to bring a claim is used as an affirmative defense, the argument is in reality a capacity affirmative defense pursuant to Texas Rules of Civil Procedure Rule 92.3, which requires a verified denial on the trial court level to be argued on appeal. Additionally, to the extent that this court might be inclined to disregard the precedent of Jenkins and determine that the argument was not waived at the trial court level, we're prepared to take the argument on its face. With respect to that, we demonstrate to the court that Dr. Owen's claim is supported in the record by the testimony of Mr. Hurt and Dr. Owen, who testified for Mr. Hurt at trial, and supported the contention that Mr. Hurt himself was responsible for the loss of any cattle over 5 head if they were lost on his watch. He also placed a value on the cattle of between $7,000 and $8,000 total for the 10 head that are missing.
Who paid for the cattle?
I'm sorry?
Who paid for the cattle that were lost?
Nobody has ever paid for the lost cattle.
Originally.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. These are Dr. Owen's cattle. He paid for them.
Okay. So Mr. Hurt is out, no money whatsoever, correct?
No, ma'am. He is responsible to Dr. Owen.
Is not responsible pursuant to the bankruptcy court's discharge since Dr. Owen never filed a claim, correct?
No, ma'am. He has repeatedly affirmed the debt.
But you have a procedure whereby you can do that, but that procedure was not followed.
So continuing to file a claim, isn't that right, Mr. Cott? Dr. Armand doesn't have a claim legally against Mr. Hurd for the lost cat.
No, ma'am, I disagree respectfully. Over and over and over again, Jay Hurd has identified to Dr. Armand his intention to make good this debt. He has reaffirmed this debt.
But did he follow the procedure under the bankruptcy code, did he?
Who, Jay Hurd?
Dr. Armand or Jay Hurd, either one.
Jay Hurd identified Dr. Armand as a creditor in his bankruptcy, and he obtained a stipulation through his bankruptcy counsel that would allow him, in the event of a judgment or settlement in this case, to pay the bankrupt estate the money that was realized from any judgment or settlement in this case. And he recognized that if he obtained that benefit, it would allow him to better pay Dr. Armand. And he repeatedly, and in open court, identified his intention to reimburse Dr. Armand for the loss of these 10 head of cattle.
That if Dr. Armand were to sue Mr. Hurd, Mr. Hurd could use res judicata in bankruptcy court, and Dr. Armand would not prevail legally.
I disagree. At this point, we have a court record from a district court in Hood County where Jay Hurd has reaffirmed the debt, and that testimony would not make it res judicata because it would be the same debt all over again.
Res judicata is not what somebody says under oath, so the court does.
If the court were to determine that this was res judicata, then that would be a determination the court would make. And I would disagree with that court's decision based upon the admissions of Jay Hurd and his liability in this instance.
Thank you.
Let me understand, Mr. Phillips, your position is that by the letter that you wrote November 19, 2010, to the court administrator, and by the document that's attached to it, it's got a title of stipulation and confirmation, which got a lot of blank spaces, and that's a funny about Dr. Owen. If that document is sufficient to take the bankruptcy court procedures and rules and laws out of effect in this case as far as the liability for the payment of lost cattle to be there would be a legal liability in Mr. Hurd. And you think that his testimony in trial is sufficient on this letter you sent to the clerk to take this out of the race to Chicago discussion?
Yes, sir.
And was this, I asked Mr. Keith about this document that I didn't find it. I looked at the trial record. I didn't find it among exhibits.
That's correct, Your Honor. What happened in this case is that after we've been litigating this case for over a year, counsel on the eve of our pretrial, counsel for the appellate filed a suggestion of bankruptcy identifying that the case that Mr. Hurd had filed bankruptcy, and the court coordinator called my office indicating that the judge was very concerned that this case was set to go to trial with the jury, and what effect was this suggestion of bankruptcy going to have on on his trial? And I assured the coordinator,
yes, sir,
that we had obtained a stipulation from the bankruptcy court and the bankruptcy trustee that would allow us to proceed with this case.
So the court of trial court was concerned about following the state provision of bankruptcy. That's what the trial court should go ahead and file.
That's
Chapter 13 then filed.
That's correct.
Was the Chapter 13 still the plan on the payment of the Chapter 13? Is it still making the payments at the time of trial?
Yes, sir.
So the bankruptcy is not completed as of the time of trial?
That's correct, sir.
And let me ask you another question. In terms of the provisions on the documents that are the land or grazing leases, the exhibits 7 and 8. Those exhibits, one is in favor of a standard investment company as the lessor to your client, Mr. Hurd. It's a one-page document with no signature. Was that form of document what was actually admitted in the trial court?
Yes, sir.
And how I understand that, that one page was Exhibit 7.
Yes, sir.
That's on the careful records plate.
Yes, sir.
And then under Exhibit 8, the document that's entered that is showing the SRB Molly Houston, and but there's no signature for Molly Houston on the document. Is that the exhibit that was entered in the court report?
I believe that's the exhibit that plaintiff offered. My recollection is, without having a record to look at, that we offered many of the same exhibits that the plaintiff and defendant at trial, and they may very well have offered a different version of that same document.
Okay, well, I'll call your attention to paragraph 26 in the lease agreement, that is the lease agreement on August 15th of 2004 between Standard Investment Company and POV Resources Center. And then paragraph 26, it talks about the ownership interest of Standard, which gives them rights to renew a call against lease that it holds to.
Yes, sir.
One of those ones didn't have a right, that's not it.
That's correct.
Which one?
I believe that it's the second one, Judge. I believe the testimony at trial was that at some point, Mr. Hurd had been directed to begin making his payments to Standard Investment after he'd been making those payments to Molly Houston. And once he did that, then he continued to occupy the property. He never was discharged from the property and was told to leave the property and was there, I believe, from 2005 to the end of 2008.
And he made the payments after some notice to a Standard Investment Company as opposed to Molly Houston?
Correct, sir.
Thank you. That's my question, sir.
I'd like to, I think your time's up, but I still would like an answer to this. I'm going to shift gears a little bit and ask how your client had standing to sue to terminate an oil and gas lease that he was not a party to.
That's a fantastic question, Judge, and I really appreciate you asking it. One of the cases that the appellants have relied upon in making their third party argument is Basic Capital Management Incorporated et al. Versus Dynex Commercial Inc. 254 Southwest 3rd at 508. They cite this court to that case out of the Court of Appeals. At the time that their brief was filed, that case had been overturned by the Supreme Court for 2 months. There, the Supreme Court was concerned with the claims of hopeful third-party beneficiaries to a loan commitment that was made to a parent corporation that was supposed to bring two additional savers. This is a unique term that the court is aware of and understands. And so they were supposed to bring two additional savers that were not yet even in existence at the time the loan commitment was made back to the original, to the lender, to make additional loans. So these two savers were created, and they were brought to the party, and the original lender said, no, we're done. We're not gonna loan you any more money. And the Court of Appeals in Dallas said that's the correct decision. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not the correct decision. The Supreme Court said if Dynex and Basic did not intend the commitment to benefit ART and TCI directly, then the commitment had no purpose whatsoever. And Your Honors, this lease, this oil and gas, paid up oil and gas lease, references the landowner and the landowner's tenants over and over and over again. And I would submit that this case is identical to the Dynex case to the extent that if you don't give some credence to the language and the landowner's tenants, or the lessor's tenants, then every single time this 11,000 acre ranch wanted to lease the property to somebody else over the course of an oil and gas lease that depending on production might last several decades, they would have to go back to the oil and gas company to renegotiate the lease for permission to be able to give that benefit to the new potential surface estate lessee every single time. And if you don't give this language credence, then the language that's in here, just like in Dynex, is of no account whatsoever.
Mr. Phillips, I believe your time is up. Any other questions? Follow-up questions?
Thank you very much for the court's time today. I have filed a motion for leave to file a bench brief that summarizes the cases that I cited here. If the court would like those, and give those to the court. If not, clerk has a copy.
Please give those to the clerk before you leave the session.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Key, you have a vote.
Please support. Few issues. Lease termination, paragraph 18. This case is not just about $7,000 in damages and some attorney fees. Mr. Hurd claims that this 11,000-acre oil and gas lease terminated pursuant to paragraph 18. And importantly, the trial court refused to accept that argument and held that the oil and gas lease did not terminate. Now, paragraph 18, lessor's tenant is not mentioned anywhere in paragraph 18. The lessor's tenant isn't given a right under paragraph 18. It was Mr. Hurd's burden at trial to conclusively prove all of the elements of his lease termination claim, one of which included that Standard Investment Company provided with DOG written notice of a lease violation by mail, certified mail, fax, or email. There's absolutely no evidence in this case that that ever happened. Because it never happened, none of the time limits that would result in an ipso facto termination ever started. Moreover, the evidence is undisputed that DOG immediately went out to the well site and repaired this fence, fixed the damage at no cost to Mr. Hurd or anyone else within a day or two of meeting with him. The evidence is conclusive that DOG repaired this fence damage within 20 days of the date that Mr. Hurd even claims that he notified DOG orally, which would have been June 28th. It's undisputed that the work was completed by July 9th or 10th. As for that second issue, Mr. Phillips raised the issue of capacity versus standing. That argument is not brief, but I will speak about it. Standing, a component of standing is whether the plaintiff has suffered a legal injury. And therefore, under our arguments in the bankruptcy res judicata, as a matter of law, Mr. Hurd could not have suffered a legal injury because the liability that he's trying to put on to EOG is derivative of a claim brought by John Bill Oman. And because of the res judicata, that cuts that legal injury off. And all this discussion about oral testimony at court and promises to pay, that's simply not what the law says. Section 524C of the Bankruptcy Code lists six elements that are prerequisites to reaffirming a debt subject to discharge. And there's no evidence in this case of a written agreement being filed with the bankruptcy court acknowledging the debt. Therefore, reaffirmation is out the window as a matter of law. There's clear precedent to prove that. The stipulation, again, the bankruptcy stipulation, it's argued that that was evidence of bankruptcy court approval. There's two situations that are identified in the Kilpatrick case in which a Chapter 13 debtor can proceed in his or her own name. And that is if a trustee abandons the claim or the debtor files a motion with the bankruptcy court to seek approval to proceed with the claim on his own. There's no evidence in this case that that ever happened. And moreover, that the so-called stipulation, it doesn't grant anyone the right to proceed with this lawsuit. It specifically says it refers to a lawsuit settlement. Well, our case didn't settle. We're at trial, and now we're at the Court of Appeals. What did the Chapter 13 bankruptcy plan do with this lawsuit? We don't know, and the reason we don't know is because the Chapter 13 bankruptcy plan was never admitted into evidence. We simply don't know. Mr. Hurd has not met his burden. There's a question about whether the Chapter 13 plan, her payments are being made. Mr. Oman, Dr. John Bell Oman testified that he hasn't received payments. Mr. Hurd testified that he has been making payments. It's obvious why he hasn't, because he never filed a proof of claim. And there's a question about a confirmation versus discharge. For res judicata, it's not the discharge that's important, it's the confirmation of the bankruptcy plan. And there's evidence. The evidence in this case is conclusive that in October 2010, the modified plan was confirmed. That's the res judicata.
Mr. Not. I want you to tell me, I didn't see this, I've read the record. I didn't see any question here where the owners or the executors subject to interest on our standard investment company. And the court said, we want to stop having our royalty payments money on this production, and we want to cancel this lease.
No, they never did. They were sued at one point, and then they were non-sued because that is an issue that they raised. As this court knows, you can't terminate the party's rights to an oil and gas lease if they're not present and able to defend themselves. And we raised the issue, but you're right, they were never a party to this lawsuit. They never had a chance to say, whoa, we like our royalty payments. We don't want you to cut them off. We don't want you to plug and abandon all these wells. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. And Mr. Burke, we appreciate all of your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is now completely submitted, and you will be excused. Also, you will be allowed.